listening to The Finalysis with Travis Wingfield and Kevin Dern, brought to you by WelcomeToPerfectville.com. Prepare to go deep.
Hello, Dell fans, and welcome back to the second installment of The Finalysis podcast. My name is Travis Wingfield, here with Wright Travis Wright in association with Perfectville. And today's episode, we're going to try to delve into some of the things you can expect from the Adam Gase offense and the Vance Joseph defense through four games this year, through their past with previous teams, and looking forward for the Miami Dolphins. You know, it's kind of difficult to jump into a podcast mid-season, but Kevin and I are here trying to bring you some of the insights of the game. And I'm going to talk a little bit today about Adam Gase's offense. And Kevin, how you doing, buddy?
I'm doing well, Travis. Thanks for including me again in the podcast. I'm happy to be part of the series, and hopefully I can shed some light on the Dolphins' defense. And, you know, it might actually appear, you know, to be worse than it really is so far statistically.
It absolutely is. I mean, everyone's ready to jump off a cliff at this point, but, you know, I feel okay right now at 1-3. I think we'll get things fixed. The four-game homestand will certainly help. And I mentioned in the first episode, but I don't know if anyone heard that or not, but Kevin is a defensive whiz. He can break down the schemes as well as anybody I've ever met, or I guess not met through the internet. And I trust his eye as well as anybody's, and he's got some really good ideas and concepts and thoughts for what we can expect from Vance Joseph's defense going forward the rest of the season, as well as a little bit of a look back through the four games. And so with that, I want to go ahead and send it over to him. And we're running the wide nine concept this year, and we brought some cornerbacks in that we thought would be playing a little bit of press man, whether they have or not. It's been kind of back and forth, but I will kick it over to Kevin with the wide nine concept and a little bit of a description about what that means and what you can expect to see with it.
Yeah, so I think really you kind of have to rewind the clock back to 2015, and, you know, something that almost happened really made me start digging into the wide nine defense and what it really is and how it works. If you go back to after the Dolphins bye week last year when Dan Campbell took over, you know, he was thinking about keeping Kevin Coyle, ended up letting him go, and they offered a defensive consultant position, whatever you want to call that, to Jim Schwartz, the old head coach of the Lions. He had been the defensive coordinator for the Tennessee Titans in the early 2000s. And he was working with the NFL office last year, having been out of a job since he wasn't retained by Rex Ryan in Buffalo. And he turned down the position with the Dolphins ultimately. But you kind of saw some of those ideas with the wide nine spring up when Lou Anarumo, our secondary coach last year, took over. And you got to see some of the guys, you know, in particular Olivier Vernon and Derek Shelby last year, playing out wide. And that kind of got me to thinking, you know, Miami's already made an interest in this. Tannenbaum, you know, kind of had a thing with Hugh Jackson. You know, he was one of he was Hugh's agent or part of his agency for a time. And Hugh, I knew, was going to be a hot commodity coaching. I actually used to work for Anthony Munoz here in Cincinnati, and actually got to bump into him at a Bengals game, and he had nothing but good things to say about Hugh. So I kind of operated under the assumption that, you know, if Miami brings in Hugh, maybe Hugh will bring in Jim Schwartz. Hugh Jackson actually interviewed for that Bills job. Ultimately, they gave it to Rex Ryan, but Hugh Jackson later said after that interview that had he gotten the job, he would have done everything he could have to retain Jim Schwartz and that wide nine defense in Buffalo. So that kind of got me thinking that that was something that Miami may be interested in. And then ultimately they hired Adam Gase and brought in Vance Joseph, which made sense because, you know, it kind of carries over. Cincinnati, you know, kind of had that scheme with Mike Zimmer and then Paul Gunther, who's still there, that Kevin Coyle came from, and running that 4-3 kind of overlook defense. And I thought we would carry over with that. Ultimately, Adam Gase kind of dropped a nugget at his combine press conference and said we'd be running a Cincinnati-based wide nine. Well, if you watched the Bengals play last year, they really only run the wide nine look when they go to their sub packages, and that's mostly to give Carlos Dunlap and Geno Atkins one-on-one matchups. But then you look at it, and if you go back and you really study some of the wide nine history with Jim Schwartz, he and Jim Washburn, who's the Dolphins pass rush coach, assistant D-line coach this year, those guys are really the co-creators of the defense. And essentially what it is, it's a way to play a front, sort of like a 3-4, using 4-3 personnel and 4-3 formations. And the genesis of that defense actually started back in the early 2000s when Schwartz was, I think, a linebacker a coach or a defensive assistant for the Tennessee Titans. And Tennessee kept having to play Indianapolis in the regular season and in the playoffs. You know, this is obviously back when the Titans had Eddie George and all those guys were pretty good. They made it to a Super Bowl, you know, the one year and lost to the Rams. But they could never figure out how to stop Edgerrin James and that wide stretch zone run that the Colts always ran back when they had that potent offense. So Jim Washburn told Jim Schwartz, like, hey, figure out a defense to stop this. So Schwartz watches a bunch of film on it, and really the only team he saw that had success stopping the Colts running game was, surprise, surprise, the New England Patriots. And what the Patriots did is they played their traditional 3-4 back then. You had a lot more base offensive looks, so you kept that true 3-4 formation on the field. And what they'd do is they'd have their outside linebackers, most notably Mike Vrabel. I think Roosevelt Colvin was there for a time at that stretch. They would just play real wide, almost in a true nine technique on the outside shoulder of the tight end. And they had some of those big-bodied, massive guys inside. You know, Keith Traylor was there. Ted Washington was there. They ended up drafting Vince Wilfork to replace those guys. And basically what they did with that defense is those guys would just set a hard edge, and it would force Edgerrin James to cut it back inside. And when they had those massive interior players along with their inside linebackers, you know, Teddy Bruschi, who I never really liked him just being a Dolphins fan, but he was always really good. Ted Johnson was really good. And then they had Rodney Harrison as a safety, you know, just basically crushed the Colts running game because they couldn't play power and go, you know, man on man versus those big bodies.
And that would really explain all those playoff victories that the Patriots had. Not to cut you off, but those playoff victories they had in the early 2000s when Peyton Manning just had that befuddled look on his face after every single game up in Foxborough getting beaten into the mud.
And that was when you could actually bump and press receivers. And then we've got the, call it the Peyton Manning rule, but it's really the illegal contact penalty, which just stems from some Peyton Manning complaining so much after those muggings.
It's only too bad Dan Marino didn't have that rule.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, so that was sort of the genesis of the defense. And, you know, I thought with some of Miami's personnel that they had, especially Olivier Vernon, you know, you kind of go back and you look what the Buffalo Bills did in 2014 with Jerry Hughes, and you basically see the same exact type of player that Olivier Vernon was last year. You know, he played out wide. Louis Anarumo kind of gave him freedom to stand up and rush out of a two-point stance and played everyone else real wide and kind of moved Ndamukong Suh around. So when Vance Joseph came on board, they ended up hiring Matt Burke, also from the Cincinnati Bengals, who was their linebackers coach. Well, Matt Burke's career history is basically tied to Jim Schwartz. He was a defensive intern with the Titans, followed Jim Schwartz to Detroit, was an assistant there, ended up becoming their linebackers coach in 2014 when they had that ridiculously good defense. They actually led the league in rush defense that year, giving up under 70 yards a game, which even with the amount of passes in this day and age, it's still pretty impressive. Only two teams that entire season, you know, rushed for more than 100 yards against Detroit.
Wow.
And they were also the only team that year to hold the Cowboys, who had DeMarco Murray. That was his big year when he went off. They were the only team to hold Dallas under 100 yards. They held him to 73 yards rushing in that wild card game that year. So, you know, they hired Matt Burke. They brought in Jim Washburn, who's, you know, basically the godfather and co-creator of this defense. And then with some of the personnel moves, you know, they had sniffed around Jason Jones, ended up waiting to sign him after the draft. He has a wealth of experience playing in this defense. You know, he was drafted by Tennessee, played for Schwartz in Detroit. They signed Mario Williams. You know, didn't really address the front seven at all in the draft. But, you know, Kiko Alonso was a fast linebacker. They had Jelani Jenkins already on the roster, who's a fast guy. You know, they kind of sniffed around Tahir Whitehead in free agency, who had been in that defense. Even during training camp, they worked out Stephen Tulloch and Brandon Spikes, who've both been middle linebackers in that defense. So we kind of knew, you know, what to expect going into the season. Then sort of what the wide nine actually is. It's still a 4-3 defense, but you widen out the front line and you sort of truncate the area that the linebackers play in. So it's kind of the inverse of what a 3-4 defense would look like. So really you have your strong side D end, which for Miami more often than not is Mario Williams. He's actually going to play outside the shoulder, on the outside shoulder of the tight end, which is a true nine technique. And then their other defensive end, which in the base look is Jason Jones at right end. If there's not a tight end over there, he plays what Jim Schwartz would call the wide five, which is really where a seven technique would be, but he's kind of tilted in at an angle to give himself a better view of the quarterback and then gives him a better angle to wrong arm some of those plays, especially if you have, you know, a guard or a lead blocking back coming at you. You can wrong arm it and still keep your arm free to set the edge.
Can I ask you a question on that?
Back inside.
Can I ask you on that topic there, Kevin? One of the terms I heard about in terms of playing that position, you know, the five or the seven technique, is they want you to kind of play the quarterback or play the run on your way to the quarterback. Do they have some of that philosophy in that position as well?
Yeah, definitely. I think, you know, that's almost kind of what burned Miami in the Cleveland game. Cleveland, you know, especially when Terrell Pryor was under center, started running that quick zone read. And it's especially noticeable when Miami was in those nickel sets when Cameron Wake was on the field. But you saw their ends get upfield so quickly, it just left lanes for, you know, the running back. I think Isaiah Correll had, you know, two of the three big gains for the Browns that game right up the middle. And basically what it does is if that DN shoots up the field, if you block it right as an offense, you can have a guard or a tackle come free and get a hat on that middle linebacker. And we saw a lot of Cleveland's runs ended up being right up the middle against Kiko Alonso. And that, you know, Pro Football Focus has rated Kiko Alonso the third best run-stopping linebacker so far. Mm-hmm. But I think the one area he struggles with, and we mentioned this on the first podcast, is when plays come right at him. He has a tough time stacking and shedding blockers and getting off blocks or keeping an arm free just to kind of slow down the play. And Cleveland really exposed that. That was one of the reasons why before the season started, I kind of suspected Miami would keep Cameron Wake sort of as a pass rush specialist, at least starting off. That combined with him coming off the Achilles injury, he always gets upfield so fast, it almost makes him a liability in the run game.
Right.
And then under Kevin Coyle, we saw him play those techniques where he was playing a tight five or even a tight six technique. And some of those bigger tackles and tight ends, they can run block against Cameron Wake one-on-one, and he couldn't really seal the edge very well. That was kind of a weakness both he and Olivier Vernon at times had, which I think when you have this wide nine front, it's why you see guys like Mario Williams, who's 6'6 and almost 300 pounds. You see Jason Jones, who's 6'5, almost 280. You see Andre Branch, who's 6'5, almost 260, but he's got really long arms and he's really athletic. And then you have Terrence Fidey, who's just kind of a big-bodied, strong guy as well. You know, he's 6'4 and about 280 as well. So that's one of the key features of it. The other feature you have is the way you align the two interior tackles. You have a three technique in pretty much any alignment these days in football, whether it's a 3-4 defense or a 4-3 defense, just because so many teams run those under and over shifts. So you still have that with Miami, and obviously it's Ndamukong Suh most of the time. And, you know, I think any casual football fan would probably look at Sue and say, you know, he, along with Geno Atkins of the Bengals and Aaron Donald of the Rams, are probably those top three techniques. And Sue's different because he's versatile. He can play a four-eye technique. He can play the two-eye technique, which I'll touch on more in a second. He can even play some one technique in some sub-packages and shoot that A-gap really fast. But I think the main thing that makes the front of the wide nine defense different than every other 4-3 front is the guy who you would traditionally consider a nose tackle or a shade nose technique guy, which in Miami's case, it's Jordan Phillips, and was Earl Mitchell for a time until he got hurt. Mostly it's been Phillips, and then when they go to sub-packages, Sue takes over that look. Is when he's in a base look, he's actually lined up in a two-eye technique, which is actually on the inside shoulder of the guard to his side, as opposed to the outside shoulder of the center. And Jim Schwartz came up with this philosophy back when they had Albert Haynesworth. Haynesworth, you know, came there out of Tennessee.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't really developed. He was just a big dude, 6'6", 350. And Tennessee at the time, before they switched to the wide nine, was playing that same 4-3 overlook we tried to see Miami do with Kevin Coyle. Well, Albert Haynesworth had sort of the same problems that we saw with Jordan Phillips last year. You know, he didn't know how to use his leverage right, being a taller guy. He didn't have great hand placement. He couldn't maintain gap discipline, especially against double teams. But when they switched to the wide nine look, he basically lined up on the inside shoulder of the guard, and they told him, attack this A-gap, you know, hit anything that comes through it. Well, Albert Haynesworth, even at 6'6", 350, was so quick, he could cut off that guard from reaching or from cutting him off. And then if the center was going the opposite way on a stretch play or as some kind of power or trying to reach up and scoop the middle linebacker, Haynesworth was so damn big, he basically just blocked that center into the backfield. And if the back was going away from where Haynesworth was, you basically bounced him right out into a defensive end. Well, Tennessee had Javon Kearse, who was one of the best defensive ends in the league at that time, sitting there waiting, and they had two fast linebackers in Keith Bullock and David Thornton, who just cleaned up tackles after that. If the play came at Haynesworth, you know, he was so big and strong, he could just manhandle that center and would kind of muck up the running lane for the back, so the back would have to try and bounce it back to the opposite side or try and bounce it outside to the other end, and you ran into Kyle Vandenbosch, who, you know, for all intents and purposes, was a pretty solid player, definitely a good run defender, you know, enough so that Jim Schwartz brought him to Detroit, and Vandenbosch played there for a number of years as well. And you kind of take it, you know, that's really the basis of that front line, is you want to play wide and attack and cause havoc, you know, penetrate and get into the gaps and just muck up the running lanes while you're trying to get to the quarterback and ultimately get him under duress. The difference, you know, in the second level of the defense is the linebackers. More often than not, you're probably not going to have that strong side linebacker walked up in the line of scrimmage or even in a one-by-one set off the line of scrimmage, which we saw a lot with Ko Amisi, you know, over the past couple years when Kevin Coyle was here. That strong side linebacker is going to be protected. More often than not, he's going to be on the lined up outside the shoulder of the tackle, back at the same depth where the middle linebacker is. That middle linebacker is probably going to play, you know, almost a zero technique over the nose, or he's going to be on that inside shoulder of the center, you know, basically eyeball to eyeball with the quarterback or the running back. And then your weak side guy is going to be kind of protected by that two-eye technique, where he's sort of playing the outside shoulder of the guard, but again, off the line of scrimmage. And their responsibility is to basically play their gap integrity. The middle linebacker has both the A gaps in this look, and the Will and Sam only have one gap, but they basically have to run up and fly up and make those plays because the defense is getting up the field. And that's where it can kind of burn you, is if, you know, you have a really good offensive line. For instance, Dallas, we kind of saw this a little bit when we played them in the preseason. If you can run those pulling plays or power plays or ISO plays, or even sometimes a good draw, if you can influence the middle linebacker or false key him, there's going to be seams that are open. I think one of the things that helped in Detroit, and especially with Buffalo, is they both had big physical middle linebackers. You know, Detroit had Stephen Tulloch, who, you know, he's only 5'11", but most of the time he was there, he was listed between 245 and 255 pounds. I mean, that's pretty much a bowling ball. And then Buffalo, when they had Brandon Spikes, Spikes was actually rated the number one run-stopping linebacker. Spikes was 6'2 and about 255, 260. I mean, that's just a big dude playing linebacker. I think that's sort of one disadvantage Kiko Alonso has, is, you know, he's not even 240 pounds. I kind of tried to compare him to Tahir Whitehead. If you don't know, Tahir Whitehead had to replace Stephen Tulloch when Tulloch got hurt and tore his ACL celebrating a sack in that 2014 year. Whitehead actually moved from strong side into the middle, and Detroit ended up playing with Ashley Palmer, who was a former college safety, and Kyle Van Noy, who was a rookie at strong side the rest of the season. Well, Tahir Whitehead's only 6'2", 240, 242, so he's pretty close in size to Kiko Alonso. He's faster than Kiko Alonso and more athletic, which I think gives him a little bit more ability to kind of run around some of those blocks and play sideline to sideline. I think the unexpected thing Detroit unearthed when they put him there was just how strong he is for such a compact frame. He's able to wrong arm and take on those blocks, and it certainly helped having a defensive line as deep as Detroit's that year. On the interior, they had Ndamukong Suh, Nick Fairley, C.J. Mosley, Andre Flewellen, Caron Reed was a rookie that year. So they had a lot of bodies that they could keep fresh in front of them. And, you know, I think that's something Miami's tried to do, but, you know, Julius Wormsley's not quite there yet. Chris Jones, I don't think, is really a good fit. Earl Mitchell, you know, he's hurt again, you know, and I wouldn't be surprised if he's played his last down as a Dolphin.
Yeah, absolutely.
But, you know, having speed on those outside linebacker positions and having a guy who's more physical in the middle, I think is the key. And that's sort of the weakness Miami has. You know, Koamisi's not really a fast guy. He's physical. Jelani Jenkins has just been bad to the point where he's getting false keyed and making bad reads where, you know, he's almost too fast and he's going the wrong way and losing his gap discipline. I thought Donald Butler showed pretty well in the Bengals game. I'd almost be inclined to try and see him at middle or even Koamisi in the middle and pop Butler at Sam and Alonzo at will. But, you know, it's kind of hard to make that adjustment midseason, especially when Kiko Alonzo, for all his shortcomings he has actually been playing pretty well, unless the ball's coming, you know, right up the gut at him. But that's sort of the basis of what the front seven looks like in the wide nine. And from there, you can kind of play any manner of coverages out of that defense. You know, Jim Schwartz, when he was with the Bills, most recently in 2014, ran press man, off man, you know, a cover two shell, quarters, traditional cover two, like you would have seen, you know, from the Tampa Bay Buccaneers in the early 2000s, ran a bunch of different things. Terrell Austin came over and coordinated the Lions defense in 2014. He came from Baltimore as the Ravens secondary coach, and they run all kinds of different things. They were playing stubby coverage, which, you know, that's probably its own podcast in and of itself if you want to delve into that. But he was playing stubby coverage. He was playing some wall coverage inside, you know, cover two, cover four, single high safety. With Miami, I think our corners are a little bit limited right now, especially having a rookie in Howard and, you know, another young guy in Tony Lippett who's still transitioning to this position. And, you know, for what it's worth, I think Vance Joseph's thrown a lot at him. We've seen him play some press man, true man-to-man coverage, maybe not as physical as I'd like, but they've played it. They've played some off-man. You know, Vance Joseph comes from that Wade Phillips school where you're going to operate out of a two-shell. So we've seen a lot of that with safeties rotating late right before the snap. We've also seen, you know, at least in the Bengals game, a safety walked up in the box to help stop the run. And surprisingly, that was more often Issa Abdul-Kaddous or Michael Thomas with Rashad Jones playing single high. I think maybe that's because Rashad Jones is just so athletic, you kind of had to help, you know, Tony Lippett on A.J. Green a little bit more than you normally would have. Maybe if Byron Maxwell was out there, hopefully Chris Culliver can kind of lock that down when he comes back, and hopefully that sounds like a week or two away. But Rashad Jones is just so athletic. You can kind of do whatever you want. You know, the coaches seem to have a thing for Michael Thomas. They rotated him with Abdul-Kaddous in the Bengals game. I'll be interested to see how that goes. I thought IAQ had played pretty well. He had a bad game against New England, but, I mean, pretty much everyone on the Dolphins defense other than Sue had a bad game that day.
Yeah.
So that's one thing I'm anxious to see this weekend.
Yeah, I'm with you on that idea. I wasn't really sure of the move when I first heard about it, but they do seem to run Michael Thomas out there quite a bit, whether it's in nickel packages or back as the additional safety next to Rashad Jones. I did want to ask you, Kevin. You mentioned a couple players from the Lions. I know you've been kind of harping on this on the message boards as well. Is I know you're a big fan of Tahir Whitehead, and you were a big proponent of bringing him over this way, and you've been talking about defensive end Devin Taylor quite a bit as well. So that my question to you is, Do these players fit the scheme they want to run, or are they trying to force this scheme because that's the kind of personnel we have?
Yeah, it's kind of hard to tell. I think at least for this season, you know, it was interesting in the pre-draft process. They kind of sniffed around a lot of guys who were more cut for the you know, that 3-4, that hybrid defense you see in the NFL. Kind of taking over popularity. You know, the Jets run a version of it. The Arizona runs a version of it. Even Denver, some of the looks that they ran before Wade Phillips took over, when Jack Del Rio was their defensive coordinator, were of that type of defense. But I think, you know, Miami's pretty well stocked for that 4-3. They don't really have those big, massive pass-rushing linebackers. So I think, you know, converting would be pretty tough to do. And, you know, obviously Ndamukong Suh's had his best success in this defense. you're paying him $114 million. You might as well do what he knows and try and make it work.
Right.
And the thing of it is it does work. You know, Philadelphia is running the defense this year under Jim Schwartz. I believe after three games, they were number one in the league in points allowed. That may have changed since they were on the bye this past weekend. But they've been running it very well. Detroit in 2014 ran it very well. I think their biggest thing is they've lost so many players off of that defense, you know, including Ndamukong Suh. Nick Fairley's gone. George Johnson's gone. They're probably going to lose one of the two between Ezekiel Ansah and Devin Taylor over the next year or two. You know, DeAndre Levy was hurt and missed most of last year. So I think that's the reason they've kind of tailed off. But, you know, I like the defense. I think Miami's personnel are suited to it. I think in today's NFL, it's kind of unique. You know, you don't really see it a whole lot week to week, especially if you're a team that, you know, is run heavy like Dallas or Cincinnati at this point. It's tough to prepare for. You can do a lot out of it, and you can kind of mix up your coverages and your blitzes and things like that. So, you know, I like it. As far as Devin Taylor goes, that's a guy I know CK Parrott had on thefins.com, and CK Parrott on Twitter had a huge man crush on him in the draft. I can't remember which year he came out. I want to say 2013 maybe. But he's really grown. He's put on a lot of weight. You know, he's 6'7", about 280 right now. He's probably Detroit's best pass rusher outside of Ziggy Ansah. You know, I think he's just tailor-made for this scheme. And, you know, I think with this scheme, it helps you when you have players who are familiar with it. So, at least for me, right now, unless something drastically changes and somebody gets cut, he's the top player on my defensive free agency board, you know, after this season.
And I'll take your word for that for sure. And I went ahead and looked it up for you. And of course, you're right. It was 2013 when he came out of the draft. So, 100% there, man. Batting 1,000 so far.
I'm lucky.
And I got one more question for you before we get over to the offense here. And you mentioned earlier with, you know, Jim Schwartz and Hugh Jackson. And I look at Jim Schwartz's track record, coaching defense at least. I mean, his head coaching stint with the Lions, you know, you can say what you want about it. But defensively, he's gotten performances everywhere he's been. And it's been fun to watch his attacking, aggressive style of defense that he brings, whether he has the personnel for it or not. And seeing what Hugh Jackson did with Cody Kessler and Terrell Pryor down in Miami back in week three, this might be putting you on the spot here a little bit, but would you prefer we had those two guys in tandem over Gase and Joseph, or are you still privy to Adam Gase and Vance Joseph here in Miami?
You know, I think if we had hired Hugh Jackson, I would have been just as happy, but just some of the things that Anthony Munoz shared with me, just made it sound like Hugh Jackson was never really a fit here. You know, it sounded like Hugh Jackson wanted to have a pretty large hand in terms of personnel. I don't think it's any small coincidence that every single one of the Browns draft picks, you know, what did they have, 12, 14 guys, all made the roster. You know, are those guys really roster worthy, or are they on the roster because Hugh Jackson had a large hand in picking them? At this point, you know, knowing what I know about Vance Joseph and his time here in Cincinnati, and knowing that Adam Gase kind of comes from that Nick Saban school of thought, I think if they can get some of the things ironed out on both sides of the ball and, you know, build, you know, personnel up over the next year or so, I think that Gase and Joseph will end up proving to be the right combination. You know, you look at the defense, obviously Miami needs a lot of talent at linebacker. We have, you know, young corners playing right now with Maxwell being benched and Culver being hurt. Offensively, you know, the offensive line is still kind of a mess. Ryan Tannehill is still adjusting to the new offense. Certainly didn't help either side of the ball that three of the first four games were on the road. Two of them against Super Bowl contenders in Seattle and New England, and another against, you know, the Bengals, who, you know, over the last probably 5 or 6 years have probably the most talented NFL roster. It's just been one thing or another why they haven't won a playoff game. But I mean, you know, they're a perennial playoff contender. So I'm anxious to see what happens over the next four games. I think we'll kind of come back to more of a balanced, you know, approach to it. And here, I guess that's not the right way to word it, but we'll kind of come back to zero. You know, we'll get more data.
Right.
There won't be so many outlying performances like, you know, hanging 30 on the Browns that second half of New England. You know, the offense looked unstoppable mm-hmm. most of the time in that half. And then the Browns game versus, like, Seattle and Cincinnati, we couldn't do a thing. Defensively, same thing. You know, Seattle and Cincinnati, we pretty much shut down their offense, save for a few big pass plays in each of those games. But Cleveland, with Terrell Pryor playing quarterback, put 24 points on the board. I guess one was a pick six. But they missed, you know, what, three field goals. So they could have had, you know, quite a few more points. And then Jimmy Garoppolo basically looked like Joe Montana out there in the first quarter and a half. So I think we'll kind of come back to, you know, a true sense of what this team really is after another, you know, three, four games.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. You know, the sample size is something I've been kind of harping on the past week, because you can't go on Dolphins message board or Twitter without people just losing their collective minds or what they've seen
right.
so far. And, you know, it's three games on the road against pretty tough teams. And you mentioned the Bengals having the talent they do and not being able to secure a playoff win. That primetime shrinkage kind of wore off onto us in that game. So yeah, it was a game we're supposed to lose, and
yeah.
I don't want to judge too much off of that. But that does kind of lead me into, you know, that the Hugh Jackson, Adam Gase conversation kind of leads me into my point with the offense here. You know, you have it so well defined on the defensive side of the ball, and you're super informative, and I love it. And as I was going over some of the games today, you know, we talked about recording this, and I wanted to get a feel for some of what Adam Gase did with the Bears as well as the Broncos over the last 3-4 years. And it's hard to get a finger on the pulse, because he adapts his scheme so well to the personnel that he has that you don't really know what you're going to get. And it's been such a mixed bag through 4 games with the Dolphins, whether they were trying to pound the ball on first and second down, or whether they were trying to run intermediate pass plays to pick up chunk yardage, or whether they were trying to go short to Jarvis Landry. I mean, I was there for the Seattle game in the opener, and the first two plays were those stupid little smoke screens where they run Landry out of the slot and he kind of swings out beyond the perimeter receiver who ends up failing to block Richard Sherman or Deshaun Shedd on the edge, and then you got Cam Chancellor closing down to clean it up for a 1 or 2 yard gain tops. So I mean, they've been all over the place. I don't have a feel for it so far, but I can kind of go back to you on the history of what Adam Gase has done with his offenses in both Chicago and in Denver. And we talked about this a little bit before coming onto the podcast, but you know, his personnel heavily dictates what he's going to do. And you had mentioned you saw the Chicago game from last year when they were in Seattle and they got blanked 26-0 by that. It was not pretty in the least. They got blanked. They couldn't move the ball. Their first couple of drives, they had some nice first downs. But once the Seahawks kind of got privy to their plan after the script ran out, it was tough sledding the rest of the way. He went with a lot of two tight, two back sets, one receiver early in that game, and it was actually working. I think the Seahawks were probably a little bit surprised by it, and you could tell that his plan was to get, you know, Zach Miller and Matt Forte going in that game, and not Zach Miller, check that, Martellus Bennett going in that game, and it worked periodically throughout the beginning, but as time wore on, like I said, they really stalled out. But Matt Forte was his bell cow. And we talked a little bit about Clyde Christensen, who is the offensive coordinator under Adam Gase, and trying to figure out exactly who has autonomy in terms of what this offense does. And it's got to be Coach Gase. I mean, that's the obvious answer. But you see a lot of the ties in with Clyde Christensen's offense that he learned back in his days with, you know, the Indianapolis Colts when they had Edgerrin James, and even leading up to Joseph Addai in the Super Bowl year for Peyton there. And I think it was 2006. They liked
that. Moore on that staff too. He's a coaching legend,
isn't he? That old famous look of his on the sideline with the glasses tilted over below his nose, and the gray, the white hair flowing in the wind. I guess there is no wind in the RCA Dome / Lucas Oil Stadium, but you get what I'm saying.
Yeah.
And so, but going back to your point about that wide nine defense and how it was designed to stop that stretch run, you know, a lot of those principles are stuff that Clyde Christensen learned when he was the receivers coach at in Indianapolis. And yes, I've seen a lot of it with the Dolphins this year. It's been a mixed bag in terms of who they put on the field. Game one was Arian Foster for 90%+ of the snaps. I think he got 45 out of the 53 snaps in that game on offense that we ran. And there was a lot of those stretch principles where they try to get a guard pulling out to one side and they they kind of seal off the edge and ask Arian Foster to make a linebacker miss in the hole and make a quick decisive decision when he cuts up field. And those lanes just weren't there in that game. But we saw it a lot with Matt Forte. No one carries the ball more than Matt Forte did over the last 5-6 years he was with Chicago. And I get the feeling that that's all Adam Gase wants to do. He wants to highlight his best player and get him the football. And we've seen it with Jarvis Landry here and there. But those stretch runs that Chicago ran, I've seen Jay Ajayi run it a few times, especially in that Cincinnati game. And he looked pretty decisive and ran with some power on those stretch runs to the outside. We saw Kenyon Drake score a touchdown in the New England game on that play, heading for the pylon to the right side of the formation. So I'm a big fan of what he's doing with that offensive scheme on the running side. And you mentioned this to me before the podcast. We talked about it on the first show, too, that everyone besides Foster, who doesn't count because he's played, you know, 1.25 game, is averaging over 4.2 yards a carry in that scheme. And so to see him get away from the run as much as they have has been a little bit perplexing. I kind of complained about him going to it too much in the Cleveland game, but, man, he sure gave Kenyon Drake a good deal of carries in that. And he was looking good, and then he's kind of inexplicably went to the next back on the depth chart. I think he went to Ajayi right after that, or maybe it was Pete, I can't recall. But yeah, he likes to run his offense through those backs if he has them. I don't know that he feels he has them. We talked in the offseason about how we all wanted Lamar Miller back, and yeah, I don't think
the front office, the CJ Anderson fiasco,
the good old 5-day restricted free agent window. I think most of the fans agree we wanted Lamar Miller back. You know, he never really got the Lions share. Well, he got the lion's share, but not enough carries to justify how well he was playing at, you know, 5 yards a clip with 8-9 touchdowns a year there for a couple of years in a row. We wanted to see more of that in a more expanded role for Lamar Miller, and especially as his pass catching came along, because you saw what Adam Gase had with Matt Forte catching 100 balls in Chicago prior to when Gase was there, but he is capable of 100 catches in a season. So he wants a back that can do all three phases. He wants a back that can run the ball, catch the ball, and is a force in pass protection, doesn't leave the field. I think you saw that in game one with Arian Foster. Unfortunately, CJ Anderson wasn't able to get signed here. We thought he was going to be ours, but he's certainly capable of being a three-down back, and you saw it a little bit. I've only seen 2 Denver games this year, but the opener against Carolina, he looked good in and out of cuts. He was running decisively, and he was catching the ball out of the backfield, and he had a huge key blitz pickup on a third-down conversion late in that game that I was really, really impressed with. And it made me just think, I was texting my friends, I was like, man, if we had that, our offense would have a different look to it, I tell you what. So I like the concepts and the ideas he has in the run game. I just don't think he has the personnel to run it right now that he wants. I do like Kenyon Drake. Jay Ajayi was in the doghouse. Whether he is or still not remains to be seen. I'm not sure he's going to be a bell cow type of back that Adam Gase might prefer. Especially with the degenerative knees we've heard about in the past, whether that's true or not, I'm not 100% sure, but it is there. It's information that's there for us to look at. So I think Drake is more of a complimentary change of pace type of guy, which I'm thrilled to have him. You know, third round pick is not too bad for that type of player. But I think they do want to put an emphasis on finding, I don't know who it's going to be. I mean, I think Dalvin Cook fits this offense like a glove in the draft. Leonard Fournette's a pretty good runner. Nick Chubb is out there, Royce Freeman. I mean, the choice of running backs in this class, it's unbelievable. So I think that he's going to end up finding his back in the draft this year within the first couple of rounds, I'd imagine. If it's Dalvin Cook or Leonard Fournette or Nick Chubb, it's going to be the first round. And if it's anybody else, it's going to be beyond that, obviously.
Yeah, let me jump in.
Please do.
Just a point and then a question. Or really 2 questions, I guess, you know, as it relates to Nick Chubb. You know, I've seen him play a handful of times. I haven't watched that many Georgia games or recently, but, you know, he kind of reminds me more of C.J. Anderson than anyone else that I've seen so far in college. You know, that kind of stocky, low-to-the-ground guy that's kind of got some surprising speed to the edge. You know, maybe just can you touch on what your thoughts are with Chubb if you've seen him, you know, multiple times? And then, you know, we kind of heard a little bit today, a couple of my friends were talking about it with – you know, Gase kind of made it sound like he wanted to cut back on that 4-man running back rotation and go to 2 guys. My initial thought with that was, you know, it's probably going to be Jay Ajayi and Kenyon Drake, at least until Foster comes back. You kind of have a bigger back. And then, you know, we saw Kenyon Drake have success with those stretch plays. What are your thoughts on that? Like, if you could pick any two of those four guys out of that rotation, who would you pick and why?
I'm with you on Ajayi and Drake. I think they offer the most in terms of talent. There's five backed on this roster, man, so it's kind of hard to figure out what they see.
I guess I should have said, you know, who would you pick until Arian Foster's back? Because, you know, you said he got, what, 43 of the 50-some snaps against Seattle?
Yeah, so
it sounds like he's back. He's going to get at least half that load.
But it makes you wonder if they're going to cut him down because of the fact that he couldn't go more than five quarters without getting injured. So
that's true.
I'm with you on that. I would prefer, honestly, I like Arian Foster. I think he's a good player. I think he offers something. Is this team going to be a playoff team this year? I never thought so. I still don't think so. I think 1-3 pretty much tells us we're not going to be at this point. I think we're capable of winning 7 or 8 games, but does Arian Foster really need to be in the mix for this team to get where they want to go ultimately? I don't really think so. So while he might be the best back, I do think that the team would be best served to see what Jay Ajayi and Kenyon Drake can do in terms of a duo going forward, because like you said, they complement each other well. You have the power back that you'd hope can convert short yards, because God knows we haven't converted a short yardage play since Lusaka Polite was here.
We miss Lou.
I like chanting Lou, not Sue, right? Mm-hmm. But anyway, I don't think Isaiah Pede's long for the roster. Damian Williams is more of a special teams guy, can kind of come in and catch a pass. And, you know, he's made some big plays in the offense this year. I think he had a big pass in the Seattle game as well as the Cleveland game. But, I'm with you on Drake and Ajayi. As far as Nick Chubb, I haven't got around to him as much. I spent more time on Cook and Fournette. I have a full-on man crush on Dalvin Cook. I think he offers everything an offense could want. He has that work done type of balance and gap recognition, and that's not just because he's Florida State guy. You can actually kind of see it, but he has that speed and that burst, but also the low center of gravity and the power between the tackles. He's an exceptional runner. He can catch out of the backfield, and he likes to block too, so he does everything.
He's from Miami, so you know, bring the kid home.
There you go. I mean, we have enough back talent in our own backyard. Why not take advantage of it, right? Nick Chubb, I'm with you on the Anderson comparison. I'd like to watch more of him, but he does seem like he kind of gets the ball and picks a hole and goes, and I like that about him. He's downhill, a little thicker in the thighs and in the backside, if you will. But I don't want to comment too much on him just because I haven't watched enough of him. I think the injury might actually keep him out of the first round, or the injury concerns, I should say. But I guess we'll see, man. We got a long way to go to the draft, but definitely can upgrade that unit in April next year, and I hope we do that rather than going to free agency, because as you know, free agency has not been too kind to us over the years. So, I mean, that's the running game, and I thanks for asking those questions, because it's a good thing to look at going forward, because, you know, Adam Gase has had guys in the past that I don't think they're on this roster right now. Kenyon Drake is going to be here, I think, long term. I could see Jay Ajayi being moved at the end of the year unless he really picks it up over the last 12 games, so.
I mean, not to interrupt again, but I look at Kenyon Drake and I just see him as like, he screams number two running back to me.
He does.
Like he can catch passes. You can use him as a kick returner, special teams guy. I just don't think he can hold up. And, you know, obviously he would have gotten more snaps at Alabama if he could, but he just screams number two back to me.
And I was going to say that's exactly the role he played at Alabama. You know, that touchdown run he had on the kick return and against Clemson in the national title game was pretty impressive. And he was a big play guy, you know, and he can run for a bit of power, and he likes to spring his runs to the outside eventually, but I've seen him stick his nose in there and get dirty a little bit, so I'm looking forward to seeing more work out of him. Disappointed he only got 2 carries last game. Hopefully that changes. Excuse me.
Yeah.
But enough on the running game. We know, I personally love defense and running game. If it was up to me, we'd be playing the games like the Vikings have lately and the Broncos, but this league centers on the passing game, and that's where we're going to make our bread and butter, because that's what Adam Gase, I think, prefers to do. And I think that's what Stephen Ross wants to do with Ryan Tannehill and the receivers we have here. I think our roster is more built towards passing the football at this point. So to kind of get into some of the passing schemes, we had talked a little bit earlier about the Denver Broncos concepts from those Peyton Manning years. And we mentioned on the first episode of the podcast how Peyton Manning has the PhD in the offense and Ryan Tannehill is still a high school graduate. So there's a lot of room to grow and a lot of time to grow. And I think he will. I was actually looking at some of the stats today, and I'm a big proponent of touchdown percentage, interception percentage, and yards per attempt. And if you look at the incline of Ryan Tannehill's yards per throw average over the course of his career, his rookie year it was 6.2, the second year it was 6.7, the next year it was 6.9, and then last year 7.2, and so far this year he's up at 7.8. So a dramatic jump so far in the yards per attempt in the passing game. And I think you can kind of blame that on the receivers a little bit because we have the best receivers he's ever had here right now, and also some of the concepts and schemes that Adam Gase likes to attack the intermediate parts of the field. And with, you know, with those routes, his concepts attack all levels of the field almost on any given play. And I really like that about him. He likes to spread the defense out, not just vertically, but also horizontally. You know, he runs a lot of those. We talked about the smoke screens earlier. He can set that smoke screen up and get you with Jarvis Landry for a couple of yards. And then he can run that fake smoke screen and leak out Kenny Stills or maybe even a back out of the backfield or perhaps an uncovered tight end or maybe one that's matched up on a linebacker down the other side of the field and gets a
lot. Let me jump in real quick about the smoke screen plays, because I thought of this right after you mentioned it earlier. You know, it just seems to me like Jarvis Landry's not quite fast enough or the receivers aren't blocking well enough. But what would you his speed?
I lost you there for about 5 seconds. Can you start ask that question again?
Oh yeah, you know, with some of the smoke screens and stuff, you know, to me, especially in the Seattle game, it just seems like Jarvis Landry's kind of, you know, a touch slow, and then Kenny Stills, I think he's been called for at least 2 holding penalties this year trying to block. What would your thoughts be about using Jakeem Grant as the primary receiver on those smoke screen plays versus Landry or even Parker?
I've been pleading to get Jakeem Grant on the field this year, man. I don't understand why he's not, because he has that fire, and we saw him kind of explode onto the scene in that first preseason game against the Giants up at the Meadowlands. And they ran that stacked formation that we kind of were talking about earlier with the 3 receivers to one side where they flex out Jordan Cameron on the opposite side and try to isolate a man-to-man situation on the one side. Well, if you get Jakeem Grant on the butt end of that diamond out there, that triangle, if you will, he's a deadly weapon that can create problems with his speed. And so I'd love to see some more of that. And I think Leonte Carew would be a great option to be a blocker out there. I don't think that Devontae Parker is as much of a willing blocker as Carew might be. I think Landry might be better served as a blocker as well. Because that's, like you mentioned.
I agree with those two, yeah.
Like you mentioned, Landry doesn't have that acceleration. You know, he's in and out of cuts quickly, but he doesn't really have that top-end speed that like Ted Ginn would hit, you know, when he comes out of when he runs a straight line. So I'd like to see that a lot more, absolutely. Than we have. I want to see more of both the rookies because I think they both offer different skill sets, and going forward, they're going to be big parts of this offense, I would hope, in the future. And Kenny Stills, those 10-yard penalties with the way this offense is designed right now, you know, Adam Gase mentioned he wants to play the game within 10 yards of the line of scrimmage, and the way this offense is built, we can't afford to be first and 20 because it's not being on schedule and we're not going to get those first downs at that point. So I'm with you there. You know, those passing concepts are brought over from Denver. Another one that I noticed from the Denver tape is that they like to run a lot of complementary routes. And one of my favorite ones they run is like a double in cut where the slot takes an in and takes a linebacker or a safety with him. And then either Devontae Parker or Kenny Stills, whoever it might be on the edge, all they have to do is beat a corner on an inside release and get to the inside shoulder. And they have a catch and then green grass to turn it upfield and make a play. And Denver had that as a huge staple in their offense, where they would clear out Demaryius Thomas, and he made a lot of big plays running towards the middle of the field, towards the hash marks, and then slipping tackles. And I think Devontae Parker, he might not be as athletic or as fast as Demaryius Thomas, but he can run after the catch, and we saw it at Louisville, and we've seen a little bit so far in Miami. He's a pretty deadly weapon in the passing game there. So
surprisingly physical after
how
kind of lean he looks, but I've been surprised by that.
He does. He has those really thin ankles and not much of calf muscle, but he definitely plays bigger than his body looks. You're spot on with that. So that kind of covers the running game, the passing game a little bit. Like I said, it's kind of hard to get a feel for what they want to do because there's been so many inconsistencies with this season, and as well as throughout the course of his career, he's always adapted to his personnel. And I don't think he quite has the personnel here yet. I know he drafted heavily on offense. I think that Carew fits what he wants to do. I think Grant fits what he wants to do. You know, in the preseason, I was a big fan of Kenny Stills. I thought he'd be included in the offense, possibly the Emmanuel Sanders type. And he will run some of those double moves, some of those post seams, and some of those corner routes flag routes, if you will. And he gets open on him, and he's had the big play in Cincinnati and the chance for the big play in the Seattle game. But I don't know that he's long for this roster, because you got Carew
at the end of the year.
Yeah, he is, and that's why I just don't see the money being designated for him. I think he probably could be better served somewhere else. I like the kid. I want to see him stick around. I like him as a player. I like him as a person. But
yeah,
I just don't know that he's long for this offense, because he kind of seems to be the odd man out at this point. So I think
let me ask you this. I'd be interested to get your take on it. You know, excluding the O-line, because we know that's still kind of a mess, and excluding Ryan Tannehill, because I think you have to give him a fair shake this season and let him, you know, play out the string. You know, if there's some element that you saw from watching Gase's offenses in Denver and Chicago, or even, you know, when Clyde Christensen was back with Indy, you know, is there a certain element you think that Miami's really lacking? You know, is it a true running back? Is it, you know, a tight end? We kind of had some hopes for Jordan Cameron, but, you know, he's, you know, seeing concussion specialist. Is it, you know, are we missing a certain type of receiver? You know, what do you think is the one thing that Miami still needs to kind of to push this thing in the right direction offensively?
That's a great question, and I think there's a really good answer for it. I think we're pretty strong on the edges. I like the perimeters we have at receiver, as well as, well, you know, Brandon Albert's left tackle right now, but I absolutely love, and we talked about in the first episode, Laremy Tunsil at left tackle. Juwan James is a bit of a work in progress, but the meat in the middle of this offense is severely lacking, and that's what you see with those third and one, third and two failures that seem to persist every single year, and this year is no different. You know, we're running with four tackles on the offensive line right now. You know, James, Bushrod, Tunsil, and Albert are all tackles by trade. So you have a lack of meat inside, and the running backs don't fit that mold either. They're compounded between the tackles. That was supposed to be Jay Ajayi,
yeah,
but we haven't seen it yet. And
like we're also two on quarterback sneaks.
He's 6'5", it, 6'4", 6'5"? He should be able to have no problem with those. But anyway, you know, there's obviously no fullback on the roster, but the tight ends too. I'm glad you brought us up, because I was going to forget to mention it. I want to see Deion Sims a lot more than I want to see Jordan Cameron. Jordan Cameron's inline blocking there's nothing to see there. His routes are lazy. His hands are crappy. And Deion Sims, he's basically a glorified offensive tackle at this point that's capable of running down the field in short yardage and picking up some short yardage pass plays as well, and possibly a red zone threat. I'd like to see him going forward. I think he's long for the roster. I don't think Jordan Cameron is. So I would say beef up the middle, and this is a great draft to do it, because we mentioned those three backs in the draft, and then you got the tight ends, O.J. Howard from Alabama, Jake Butt, great name, obviously, from Michigan, and then I'm forgetting the name, the kid from Ole Miss right now, I'm forgetting his name.
Oh, Ingram.
Ingram, there you go. And so I think there's a great opportunity to upgrade that part of the team, and then possibly, you know, find a right guard, whether it's Billy Turner or free agency or the draft. I'm not sure yet, but we'll find that out. So, I mean, that's pretty much it for mine on the offense. I got the quarterback still, Ryan Tannehill. I think we've beaten that one to death. I think he's going to get the audition here. I think that once we see the mental side of the game kind of come together in this offense, we'll have a better feel for it. Because right now, he's just a kid with a great arm talent that hasn't gotten there mentally. And so I just think it's premature to say anything about him in this offense at this point.
I gotcha. I guess one more question I had was, you know, watching the offensive line when I was there at the Bengals game last Thursday, you know, Tunsil just looks so natural and his feet are just ungodly good. You know, I think you pencil him in as a left tackle for the next decade, but I don't know if you got a chance to watch him in isolation at all or not, but I was kind of curious, what would you think of Billy Turner at left guard? The reason I ask that is because, you know, Anthony Steen has played pretty well. He was a natural right guard at Alabama coming out. Craig Urbick's been a natural right guard. You know, obviously, Bushrod's there now. But, you know, just seeing some of that potential between Tunsil and Turner on the left side, what would you think about Turner as a left guard? You know, I know he played left tackle in college, but, you know, just any thoughts you had on him from the Bengals game? You know, obviously he had some down moments, but, you know, what did you think about him?
I think it'd be a great idea because you see the athleticism that he has there, and I watched a lot of his tape at North Dakota State, which kind of just proves how big of a nerd I am. there you go, Carson Wentz, right? He was so impressive out there on the edge, and I know it's FCS competition, but that kick slide that he had and the power with which he drove off of those anchoring legs, if you will, was so impressive. And I think a lot of his downfall is between the ears right now. And I think you can blame that on the fact that he's played, what's he played, left guard, right tackle, and even a little bit of left tackle too. So he's been...
I think he's took some snaps at center in practice just to be an emergency guy.
And quarterback too, for that matter, right? I mean, he's been everywhere. So I'd like to see him kind of find a home, and that might be a good spot. Before the draft happened, I had said that he was a long-term replacement for Brandon Albert, left tackle, and obviously things have changed since then. But I think I like where your head's at there, because I think he has the athleticism to be a pulling guard. He's great in the running game when he knows where his assignment is. But him and Tunzel both, in the last game it was Turner, but Tunzel before him, they've struggled when it comes to combination blocks and getting to the second level and trying to figure out who their assignment is. So I think that you put him at one spot. I think left guard would be a great spot for him. It's his natural side. Put him next to Pouncey, the longtime veteran, and then the athletic Tunzel to kind of make up for some of the deficiencies he might have there as well. So I think you're onto something there, and I would love to see him find a home there, because I don't want to see us cut him yet, because I think he has too much talent to get rid of him.
Yeah, and then one more question, just given that you're out there on the West Coast, just thinking about some of the talent we've had in this draft class, I think it kind of goes a little bit forgotten amongst most Dolphins fans that we've got, two picks in Brandon Doughty and Thomas Duarte, who, didn't make the 53-man roster, obviously, but they're on the practice squad. My question for you was, did you get to see a lot of Duarte at UCLA? And what would you think about him in terms of, do you think he's able to develop into, sort of that H-back move tight end, like kind of in the Jordan Reed mold? I know Denver's kind of messed around with some of those guys like Virgil Green and, Jacob Tammy over the past few years. Just curious on your thoughts on Duarte, if you'd seen him at all.
At UCLA, I didn't have much of a chance to watch him. I did get to see him in the preseason action, and I know that he was pretty much the scapegoat for some fourth quarter meltdowns we had. I think it was the block punt where he just kind of let a guy run by him with lack of effort.
The Giants game. Yeah.
So I have to admit, I haven't seen much of his UCLA stuff. So I'm not really sure if I can answer that question appropriately. I don't really want to lie to you. But I know he has that makeup. I know he's built like a beefed up wide receiver. So maybe at some point, but I think there's just so much mentally that has to be corrected with him before he can even get to that point. I did see more of Brandon Doughty. He kind of has that schoolyard mentality of just kind of, fuck it, chuck it football, if you will. And I kind of like his game. And Adam Gase had a quote in training camp saying, like, sometimes he makes completions where I just don't know how the hell he did it, but he does. And it's kind of fun to watch. So I wouldn't mind seeing more of him maybe in some preseason next year and see if he can maybe be the backup quarterback next year at best. So those two guys, you got a long way to go, obviously. But, yeah, man, let's wrap this thing up. We're getting close to an hour. Is there anything else you want to talk about on the defensive side?
Nah, I think I'm good. I was just going to ask, what's your prediction for Sunday against the Titans?
I actually just got a piece coming out. Well, we're recording this Wednesday night, so tomorrow's Thursday for those of you listening on delayed, which you obviously are. I got a piece on Perfect Field coming out tomorrow, previewing the piece. I watched two Titans games today at work. Don't tell my boss. And they look like a mess to me. They're like the worst coach team in football. Mariota, if you look at his numbers and his production and the way he's throwing off balance, it's just garbage. So I'm thinking it's going to be a blowout. I think the Dolphins get healthy at home. I think they got a lot to prove. They're going to be fiery. Second home game in the new building, or the renovated building, I should say. So I'm thinking a big win for Miami. How about you?
I always feel that way, and then they never end up winning big or it's close. I thought they were going to kind of put the Browns to bed pretty easily, and it looked like that for a while, especially in the third quarter. And obviously, we ended up probably should have lost that game if the Browns had a field goal kicker. And then we won in overtime. We blew them out last year in Tennessee. What was it, like 38-10 or 38-13, something like that?
Yeah.
I don't know. I want to say like Miami 31-17 or something, but I don't know if I can put that down confidently in pen, let alone pencil right now.
You're too jaded, man. You're a Dolphins fan. So that's what we're all guilty of. All right, buddy. Well, hey, are you on Twitter?
Yeah.
What's your Twitter handle?
Handle is KevinMD4. KevinMD4.
KevinMD4. You can follow him on Twitter. I'll have to follow you because I don't even know you were on there, and I'll have to come follow you and read some of your stuff. He also has some great posts on thefins.com if you haven't checked out that message board. You have that defensive thread stickied there still, I believe. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think there's one in the main forum, and then there's a one that's a little more in-depth in the club level if you want to pay and get a little bit more in-depth Dolphins access there at thefins.com.
Well, yeah, definitely direct them to that because it's as good of a read you're going to find on football anywhere. You know, it's not ESPN filled with LeBron and Kobe news. It's good quality football content. So Kevin Dern, KevinMD4 at Twitter. I am Travis_Wrights on Twitter. We're both with Perfectville now. So you can check out their podcast and tweet them at PerfectvillePod. Check out my segment, the Wright Travis Wright blog there. We also have the Finjury Report where we have a almost doctor, Will Maring. He's going to be a doctor here shortly once he gets everything finished up with his education. He talks about, you know, Cam Wake's injury, Devontae Parker's injury, that kind of stuff. So we get some good insight there. And that's about it from the Finalysis podcast, episode number 2. Anything else you got left to say, Kevin?
Hopefully the hurricane doesn't make us move that game to Nashville on Sunday.
That sounds like
ready to see the Dolphins play.
Sounds just like our kind of luck, doesn't it?
Yeah.
All right, Kevin, well, let's sign off and get out of here. Good episode, buddy.
All right, you too. All thanks. Right.
Thanks.
Thanks for listening to The Finalysis with Travis Wingfield and Kevin Dern. Subscribe, rate, and review on iTunes, and go to welcometoperfectville.com for the very best coverage of your Miami Dolphins. Fins up.